So we have an obesity epidemic and we have people going hungry. Can this problem be solved? Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Oh yes, and our nutritional practices are very carbon intensive. But guess what? There's a rising interest in local food. Our number 1-800-478-8255 toll free. That's 478-TALK. In Anchorage, a local call at 550-8422. Email talk at aprn.org. Food is the subject today on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Always fun to talk about food, and we're almost around to gardening season as well. I guess if you have a greenhouse, you already are into gardening season, and we'll be probably getting some calls about that as this show progresses. The germination of this one had to do with the visit to Alaska by the executive director of the New York City Coalition Against Hunger, Joel Berg, who's author of All You Can Eat, How Hungry Is America? Well, Joel, you've been here and you managed to get out in between pops of the volcano there last night, and you're back in New York City now. You went to the food banks in Alaska. I'm sure you see we have a number of challenges here.
A lot of challenges in New York as well as Alaska. I will say, little did I know that I'd be in Alaska the 1 week of a 20-year period where the air quality would actually be better in New York City than outside Anchorage, because we don't have ash in New York City. We have a lot of other things. So I'm thrilled to have been there and thrilled to be home now. But, Steve, there are a lot of challenges in Alaska. It has had the largest jump in what the federal government calls food insecurity in the entire nation, tied for last in terms of the increase in hunger with Iowa. And right now in Alaska, there are about 12% of all people in the whole state live in households that can't afford enough food. That's a 43% jump from a decade ago. Now, it's not people starving like it might be in Darfur or North Korea, but it is people choosing between food and rent, people rationing food, people actually getting obese because they can't afford the most nutritious food. So all these impacts are devastating upon the people of Alaska. And however bad the statewide numbers are, unfortunately, they're even worse in the bush.
You know, Joel, they are. When the price of crude oil spiked way up to 140, we saw the price of food follow that up last year. And that is a really scary thing, because suddenly you feel a whole lot more vulnerable because you realize, ooh, it's taken quite a lot of fuel to get this food up here. So I think we're on the horns of that dilemma as well. If the price of crude oil goes up again, which it seems likely it will, we've got a problem here. So at this point, I want to bring in our second guest, who is the president of Calypso Farm. Her name is Susan Wilsrud. And Calypso Farm is, I guess you call it, an educational farm. It's part of this community-based agriculture movement, and it's in Esther, Alaska. Susan joins us from her office there. Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Susan, tell me, you are all about trying to produce food locally. And there are those who pretty well ridicule the whole idea of any kind of agriculture industry in Alaska. But, I mean, you're more to the gardening level, right?
Right. Well, small farm and gardening. And actually, you know, we have quite a good, as home gardeners can attest to, and small-scale farmers, we have a fantastic growing season while it's happening. It is short, but the potential to grow food in Alaska is huge and underutilized. And so we, our educational farm is based around a small 2-acre production farm, but we also train home gardeners and farmers in all kinds of areas of food production, and then we also support the development of school gardens. And these gardens are incredibly, incredibly productive because we've got, with all the sunlight we have here, and we've got good soil, minimal pests, it's actually a prime growing area while we can do it. And so there's huge, huge potential. And people are doing this all over the state. It mostly flies under the radar. We have an incredible number of home gardeners. And so that's the work we're doing, is supporting those people and promoting the increased meeting our own food needs as best we can.
It would appear that this is very much on the rise. And I think what's fascinating about these community-based agriculture movements is that they provide an opportunity for people that might not ordinarily have thought of themselves of being in the agriculture business to start buying in, to poke a toe in, to get some educational opportunities for their kids to actually start growing things and even harvest the product and sometimes even sell the product.
Yes, there's a growing number of home gardeners who are starting to expand their personal gardens to maybe provide food for a couple of their neighbors. Some of those operations have gone from, say, having neighbors pitch in some money at the beginning of the season to get some vegetables to now, a few gardeners I know of now are producing vegetable shares, weekly supplies of vegetables, to upwards of 20 other people out of small home gardens. Some of the most productive and innovative gardening happening anywhere in the country is happening on a very small scale. And so it's nice to see that happening around the state.
Susan, of Calypso Farm, what got you into this business? You really sound like a true believer here.
Well, we've been growing our own food for a long time, and it's, for me, it's just a real fundamental basic need, and it ties in across, everybody eats, so it ties in across the full spectrum, and it addresses a lot of needs, so that's where we started, and it's just something that I personally feel very passionate about and feels very important.
Well, it's great to have you on the program. Our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, toll-free. A local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. And especially later on in the show, bear in mind our email address, because I can probably pull that one up off of the screen if you can't get to it on the phone, is talk@aprn.org. And especially, if we say something that you find just isn't right, we'd really like to know. Let's go back to Joel Berg of the New York City Coalition Against Hunger for a little bit more of a probe about the nature of our problem here in Alaska and in New York and elsewhere. As I understand it, Joel, you're an advocate of existing programs. Your feeling is, and this is kind of outlined in your book, All You Can Eat, How Hungry Is America, is that at one time, we were actually starting to eradicate hunger in this country, and then we started backsliding.
Absolutely. As I point out in my book, the creation of the modern nutrition assistance safety net in the late 1960s and the late 1970s, the food stamps program, the school breakfast program, which was added on to the previously existing school lunch program, the women's, infants, and children program, actually worked. I know it's shocking today to tell folks that government programs worked, but they were designed to really reduce third world style malnutrition in America. And by the late 1970s, we had all but wiped out hunger in America. Not only did we have a more robust safety net, people were making more in their jobs vis-a-vis the costs. So in the late 1970s, if you were working full time, you may still have been poor, but you weren't hungry. And that's not the case anymore. Starting in the 80s in the Reagan era, the country was sold the bill of goods that we could solve a major social problem with underfunded, undercoordinated private charity. And even though number of pantries and soup kitchens and food banks has gone through the roof, and even though groups like the Food Bank of Alaska do amazing work and should definitely be supported more, they are not the long-term solution to the problem. Our history proves that when we've really focused on getting people a safety net and getting people living wage jobs, we've made a lot of progress. And the reason we've gone backwards and hunger's gone up so quickly in Alaska and elsewhere is that we stopped doing that.
Well, Joel, you got in the news here in Alaska for kind of wagging your finger at Sarah Palin for saying she might turn down federal money for food programs. You're definitely an advocate of government money for food programs. her problem with it, as it was stated, is that it's kind of an unfunded mandate that you're starting this, and then it's going to be up to the state to pay for continuing it.
I must say, when it comes to the anti-hunger programs in the stimulus bill, the governor's defense is factually 1,000% demonstrably wrong.
Huh.
Those are all entitlement programs that all the funding the state's getting are provided by the federal government. Now, I want to be clear, because I know enough about Alaska to know Alaskans bristle a bit when some outsider from the lower 48 comes in and starts telling you how to run your state. So I want to be clear that I've been traveling around the country. I've been equally critical of governors around the country. I was in Texas, very critical of Governor Perry for turning back stimulus money. I've been very critical of my own governor, Governor Patterson, here in New York, who's a Democrat, who's actually cut funding for pantries and kitchens. That being said, to my knowledge, out of all the governors in the country who've turned down stimulus money, none except Governor Palin have talked about turning back nutrition money. Now, even if you're a conservative who opposes food stamps, and I'd plead with you to support food stamps because it rewards work. The fastest growing population of people on food stamps are working families who just don't earn enough to feed your families. But even if you oppose that, I mean, the governor is talking about turning down WIC money, money for women's, infants, and children. It prevents children from dying. How you can claim to be pro-family and then turn down money for that is beyond me. She's talking about turning down money for school meals. And even if you're against direct government benefits, she's actually talking about turning down money for the Food Bank of Alaska to distribute food mostly through churches around the state. It's just not, in my judgment, a defensible position. And it's just not true, at least when it comes to the hunger money, that it's an unfunded mandate, excuse me.
Oh, it's okay. That's Joel Berg.
Can I interject there for a moment?
Susan, go ahead.
Alaskan?
Yes.
As an Alaskan here, I just want to say that I completely 100% agree with you, Joel, because those programs are, it's what you're saying rings true across the country. WIC, senior coupons, food stamps, that's one of the first steps in the ways that we can start making food, locally grown, fresh food available to the low-income population. And I completely agree with you that it's a, you know, very sad thing to have our governor not seeing that and not appreciating that.
Well, I think
let me just make one more point on this. Ironically, it's the governor who's turning this into an unfunded mandate if the legislature allows her to go through with not taking these money. Because under federal law, the state is required to expand food stamps benefits even if the governor doesn't want to do that under this bill. Yet the money she's able to unilaterally turn down is the state administrative funds to administer the mandated growing federal benefits. So if she actually goes through with this, she's the one taking on more obligations for the state to pay for administrative funds, you know, not the federal government. And the greatest irony of all, if she turns down this money, it's not like Alaskans don't have to pay taxes on this part of it. Alaskans would be paying taxes on benefits they're not getting.
Yeah, I think we should say we could be pounding away at a straw dog here, and it could be that the governor's intent, we're not understanding it completely because she hasn't really clarified it that much at this point, and there's no one from her administration here to come in and help clarify it now, so probably we might as well stop bashing it and just move on to talk about other things. Although listeners may feel otherwise, our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. A local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, and we'll go to Muldoon, where Stu joins the program. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Stu.
Okay, thanks, Steve. We have the situation out here where we have the military reservation right over a moose fence, and there's large fenced-in areas along the gas line, and the community council over here has been talking about possibly turning it into orchards or something. We found crab apples do quite good around here. And
I would think they would.
Yeah, when people make the jam out of them, they eat the crab apple jam long before the blueberry jam and the low bush cranberry jam runs out. So, they're fenced off areas, so you just have to close the gate and let the trees grow, and then people can go out and pick them in September and October, and, you know, once the trees get established. But other than that, just east of Anchorage on the military reservation, there's vast areas that they've cleared for the moose enhancement program. Those could easily be turned into some kind of orchard if things come push to shove, you know.
Yeah, and I know that the moose are not averse to crab apples.
Well, that's why you have to fence it off. Or actually, our tree we got in the front yard here, they hang bear fur in it, and they don't like that. They seem to leave it alone.
The bear fur does the trick.
You hang a dead black bear fur, and they don't come near it. They don't like that.
I can understand that. Yeah, go ahead, Susan.
Varieties of apples can be also grafted onto a crabapple rootstock so that you can increase the diversity of what you can grow on those trees. You can, and there's somebody up here in Fairbanks, Claire Lammers, who's been experimenting for years with apple varieties. And so there are ways you can get stock, or you can actually graft right onto those crab apples, and then you can have your crab apples and your fresh-eating apples and your cider apples there, too. So
I've seen it done.
Yeah, we have the green apples, too, up in Eagle River on a grafted roots, but last summer, harvest was terrible. It was a wet summer, and
It was a rough summer.
It was a bad year. I mean, we still got some of our root crops, but some of the other was worthless.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, the fruit explorers in this state are you gotta take your hat off to those people, because that's extreme gardening there. those people are dedicated. I've been to some of their meetings, and it's just amazing. Amazing.
They're getting some good results.
You know, yes.
We help Claire harvest his apples and fill up pickup truckloads. So, you know, he's put the time in, and so now it's up to people to use some of that stuff, some of the information of the work he's done.
Stu, thanks so much for your call.
Thank you.
From Muldoon, right next to Fort Richardson there. Let's go, let's do another call here. This one down to Heidelberg on Prince of Wales, I believe. Stephen, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hi, Steve.
How are you?
Susan?
Mm-hmm.
I'm hanging in there. I was talking to some 100-year-old elders about the Great Depression, and he was kind of laughing. He said, well, right now, he said, Federal Reserve Bank is broke. All the banks are broke, and they're spending money that's not worth the ink that prints it. And he said, but up here in Alaska, he said, we can live off the land. It's a blessed country. We're blessed people. And he said, the other day, I got an email from the U.S. Health and Human Services. There's a molecule in seal fat that heals Alzheimer's. And the Tongass National Forest is so rich. There's herbs in there that are undiscovered. There's some yew wood that heals cancer of the uterus. There's a variety of roots that heals the digestive system, and our 100-year-old elders are testimony to that. One thing that I'm afraid of is herbicides and our wild renewable salmon, our wild fisheries. We've got to protect our salmon, and we have to count our blessings. You know, in Alaska, our diversity of people, and we got to protect this for our future generations. Our children's children and children. But anyway, we're a blessed people, and thank you very much, Steve.
Stephen, thank you so much for your call from down in Heidelberg, and certainly a very rich environment that you're living in. And I don't think anybody on this program is very much in favor of chemical agriculture or herbicides or anything like that.
The Alaska Community Action on Toxics is doing some great work to increase the awareness across the state of protecting our natural resources by reducing uses of those toxins.
Well, do you compost out there, Calypso?
We do. That's the basis for all of our fertility. We do composting, worm composting, large-scale compost piles, and we do the same at the schools and the school gardens.
And you are able to... I mean, some people think it doesn't work real well in Alaska, but...
It works.
I found it is kind of in turbo here.
The people who think it, who think it doesn't work haven't tried it.
Yeah. So what do you... So you probably have plenty of stuff provided to you that you can throw in there, I would think.
Yes. On our farm, we have, we have animals, and we have plenty of crops that we can just, rotate through a good composting system. And at the schools, a number of schools now. We're working with 9 schools in the Fairbanks district, 5 of which have active gardens and the others are in planning phases. But all of the schools, there's talk of how do we take some of the waste in our schools and turn it into compost in our school gardens. And so there are many challenges associated with that, but there are also many possibilities. And so one of the schools, there's a parent who has trained every school, every teacher in the school to use a worm bin in the classrooms. And that's education, reducing waste, growing food, all wrapped into one.
We got an email here from Pamela who points out that, hey, we have imported food in Alaska because we have migratory birds and animals that come in. And she says imported food can be good because there's variety, nutritional quality, and security. Plus, there's different trace elements come from different soils. Good point. And she also kind of, it's a backhanded compliment, I suppose, to the community agriculture movement, which is to feds and the university. Agriculture usually means industrial agriculture, so emphasis is not on complementary and appropriate food production and transformation. But as I understand it, the university up there has kind of been trying to be helpful, the extension people, to this community agriculture movement, as
they
I understand
are. And
it.
And I think when you're saying community agriculture movement, you might mean, I'm not sure if you mean community-supported agriculture, which is a form of marketing where people pay ahead of time for produce, or whether you mean kind of the whole movement of people growing their own gardens, growing their own food. But either way, the Cooperative Extension Service in the past years has become more and more focused on recognizing small-scale growers as part of the agricultural system, and the university has recently been holding some roundtable discussions on how can the university help support local growers here in the Tanana Valley.
All right. Well, thank you. Let's go to Shanna, joins the program from Eagle River. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Shanna.
Hi. Thanks, Steve. Can you hear me?
I can hear you just fine.
Okay. I'm sorry. I wanted to talk about the WIC program. I was a participant in the late 80s and found it incredibly useful. In fact, when I look back, I'm just very grateful for what I consider an opportunity. And that's because of the nutrition classes that we had to attend. And the information that I learned those couple of years, I've carried with me for the rest of my life. And it's really, like I said, I've just been grateful.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I think Joel's certainly a big advocate for that, and he's probably happy to hear nice feedback about it.
And ma'am, are you still on the line?
Yes, she is.
I am.
Can I ask you, are you working now?
I am.
Right, and you're paying tax. You're paying tax dollars.
Yes.
I suspect you've worked most of your life, haven't you?
That's correct, yes.
The reason I say this is every time I do shows like this, people call in or send emails or people post on blogs that everyone needing help from the federal government, is, if they're poor or struggling, they're some sort of lazy bum. And callers like this remind me day in after day out that sometimes you need a little help. Even President Obama's mother was briefly on the food stamps program, and I'd say making sure he grew up healthily was a pretty darn good investment in our nation's future. And I do point out when these conservatives, they email me via the Internet, which was invented by government. It may not have been invented by Al Gore. It was invented by the government. They ride over government roads. They use government public transportation. Many of them have gone to public schools and public universities. But when it comes to poor people or struggling people, low-income people, they seem uniquely incensed that we've moved towards this kind of socialism. I think we've had socialism over the last few decades. It's socialism for the wealthiest business leaders.
All right. Shanna?
Yes, I'd like to point out that it was very difficult for me to participate in any type of program. The only thing I participated in was the WIC program, but it's because of the stigma it was difficult to go in. And looking back, I am grateful that I did it. But
yeah.
It wasn't easy.
This is Susan here, too. I used WIC coupons when I had my kids, and I'm a farmer and I run a nonprofit, and I totally agree with you. I appreciated the service so much, and there is a social stigma, and I definitely thought about which line I would go through, which checker was going to be nice to me, because I was using this service, which is very underutilized. And I used it to get healthy food that I needed. And I definitely hear what you're saying. And, you know, I think that we need to make some steps to change that. And we're trying to do that with our farm stands and our CSA by, encouraging people to use food stamps, WIC, senior coupons.
And so how do you handle them? Let's say you've got your produce stand and your turnips or whatever, and somebody comes up with a WIC coupon or food stamps. You just
totally
take them?
Easy. We take WIC. We take senior coupons. The food stamps we take also, it's a little challenging for us because we don't have power at the farm stands that we have. So we actually take the number down on paper and we have to run it when we get home. But it's just one extra step. It's not a big deal. So, and we one of the things that we're doing is trying to get the word out in the community that we offer these services. Because as Joel knows, a lot of urban areas, including even in Alaska, they're just a food desert. There's no grocery store right there. What there are, gas stations, convenience foods, and fast food. And so to have fruits and vegetables available in downtown Fairbanks or an urban area anywhere is basically an anomaly right now. And so what we're doing is just trying to get the word out so people even know we're there. And the Food Bank of Fairbanks here is helping us get the word out and saying that, we take food stamps, we take WIC, we take senior coupons, and we're right here in downtown Fairbanks.
Are you starting plants already?
We are.
You must have a greenhouse then.
Yes, but we are also looking at the snow out there and keeping our fingers crossed and hoping it'll get warmer.
Yeah. Shanna, thanks for calling in from Eagle River with your testimonial about WIC.
Thank you.
Yeah, I got a lot of friends that are starving artists, and I tell them, you qualify for food stamps, and they don't want to do it. And it's kind of the same reason. It's like, oh, it's some kind of welfare. I'm not sure I want to be involved with that. But the fact of the matter is, if you meet the guidelines, this is there for you. It seems like sort of a no-brainer. If you don't have the money and you need food, here's the food.
Well, I tell the story in my book of a neighbor of mine in Brooklyn, New York, was panhandling right outside my house and asking for money for food. And I say, hey, this is your lucky day. I'm a hunger expert. Here's a list of food pantries and soup kitchens in your neighborhood. But you should really apply for food stamps. And he goes, I can't apply for food stamps. And I go, why not? He goes, my family would be ashamed. And we have this twisted idea in America, very different than Europe, that it's somehow more socially acceptable to ask your neighbors, some of whom are poor, to give you money for food than it is to get food from your rich Uncle Sam. And I must say, irony, some of your friends who might be embarrassed to get food stamps, I'm assuming if they live in Alaska year-round, they don't turn down their permanent fund check. I've yet to meet a single senior citizen who turns down their Social Security benefits. And people say, oh, food stamps are welfare that people didn't pay for, Social Security people paid for. But that's a totally arbitrary distinction. Many people get far more out of the Social Security system than they put in, and most people on food stamps have worked and paid taxes. So I say, if you're not embarrassed to get food stamps, if you're not embarrassed to get your permanent fund check, if you're not embarrassed to ride over a government-paved road or to have the government clean the snow away when it snows, why are you embarrassed if you have income qualifications to qualify to get nutrition help for your family?
Yes, and Joel Berg, I think we should also say, for those who didn't hear in the earlier part of the show, that you have documented in your book All You Can Eat, How Hungry Is America, that we actually almost conquered hunger in the United States by the mid-1970s, and then we backslid. So we almost made it. So it's a specious argument to say, well, it just can't be done through the government when the government already did do it.
Yeah, I am not arguing that government has the one and only responsibility for dealing with these issues. I do believe in personal responsibility. I do believe that healthy people should work and be able to feed their families. But people working full-time don't earn enough to feed their families these days. There aren't enough jobs. So for the people who are falling through, we need a federal nutrition assistance safety net. Yes, we need more help from charities. And again, I will urge all your listeners to donate money, and even better than donating food, because they buy wholesale, donate money to the Food Bank of Alaska, donate your time. But I think even more importantly than that is getting involved, contacting your elected officials, Senator Begich, Senator Murkowski, Governor Palin, and saying, boy, and Congressman Young, and saying, boy, we really need government leadership in conjunction with the nonprofit sector so we can end this problem once and for all. And, you know, President Obama has called for ending child hunger in America by 2015 as a down payment on ending all hunger in America, and I think that's a very wise pledge.
Start 'em young. All right, it's Talk of Alaska. As you might have gathered, we're talking about food, and more specifically, food in Alaska, including producing our own, as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
We're talking about food in Alaska on this edition of Talk of Alaska for this week. And we've got a farm proprietor and an executive director of the New York City Coalition Against Hunger with us. Joel Berg just got back to New York from a visit to Alaska, so he kind of has some acquaintance with our situation here, as well as our renowned volcano. Let's go to Libby, who joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Libby.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Oh, good to have you.
I just had a host of little comments. First, I wanted to thank your guest from New York. I think it's kind of obvious government has some basic responsibilities, including feeding its children. And I think most mature countries kind of take that as a given. We have a strange relationship with our government, I think, in this country. But on the topic, I'm really pleased you're talking about this. I am a total moron when it comes to gardening. I don't know almost anything about it, but I've gotten involved in this conversation because of my concerns about climate change, as everybody, you know, the carbon involved in flying our foods up here, and also food security, that I think most people have heard this, but at least in Anchorage, I think we have something like 2 days' worth of food in our grocery stores to feed this town if something were to cut off our transport systems. And so I've been involved in conversations with Bioneers, which meets every October, this national conference that gets telecast into Anchorage about these kinds of topics. The Cooperative Extension here in Anchorage is getting involved with the Municipal League talking about this. There's a local permaculture group that has started up. And people are talking about everything from what you're saying, you know, buying more local foods and educating people about that, to how to market so that people understand the importance of buying local, to, you know, putting more of our money in so the local producers can expand more, to trying to protect local farmlands, to the whole food storage question. Our food storage place is in Oregon.
Yeah.
In terms of cold food storage.
And yeah. Well, we do have that big warehouse full of carrots. In fact, I'm wondering whether we've eaten all them yet. I think we might have eaten it down.
Well, I mean, we even talk about, like, throwing out, you know, turning a lot of our lawns into gardens. We have unbelievable amount of lawns that are just taking, you know, water and time and energy that could be turned into that kind of thing. Talking about in the bush, where people are already heating the insides of their homes, how we might figure out ways that they could grow stuff inside in the winter. And the last piece I'll just kick out is, and looking again at subsistence regulations, our native folks out in the bush are the most regulated people on the planet, and sports fishermen and hunters and commercial folks often get priority over them when they need the food just to eat. So all these conversations are going on more and more, and I'm really thrilled that you're having them on the radio.
Well, thank you, Libby. When I was thinking of how we were going to book this show, I was looking at a lot of those choices that you were just talking about, because there are so many different directions in which people are seem to be becoming more aware of wanting to do something about this because of the carbon footprint or because of worries about food security or whatever, just because the food might be better.
Well, and I'll throw out one other cool thing that's happening. There's a new concept out there called financial permaculture, where people are trying to marry together the principles of permaculture, which looks at how do you, you know, have human settlements and agriculture and feed yourself in a sustainable fashion, with how do you marry that with your local economies, where you make sure that the resources of your local economy make your local economy and people, you know, vital and healthy and self-sufficient. And so there's some really cool things starting to go where people are beginning to think about their economic systems, their financial systems, and their food systems as a package. So I think more exciting concepts are on their way, I hope, at least.
All right, Libby. Well, thank you very much. That's very inspirational. I note in Anchorage that we have, I think, three, perhaps more local restaurants where the chefs are making a point now of highlighting local food, even though they might have to charge more for it, just on the idea that they might be, able to help lead the public taste toward the local food. I mean, we do root crops just absolutely great here, and yet, you know, when's the last time you ate a turnip? Scott from Juneau sent in an email and said, can somebody speak about greenhouses? Because they seem to be especially viable in places where we, as Alaskans, are developing renewable energy. And Libby sort of hit it corner-wise there when she said, you know, people are heating the insides of their homes. Maybe they can get something growing as well. But it would appear, with the work that's been done at Chena Hot Springs, that we're not too far from probably some significant greenhouse activity in Alaska. What do you think, Susan?
I think that's true. I think there's great potential both in passive solar greenhouses in the summer and just the huge increase in productivity that those can create with no energy input. And then the work that's going on with geothermal heating of greenhouses at Chena Hot Springs is just fantastic. And then there's also work being done on more energy-efficient uses of thermal mass, you know, river rock and small-scale greenhouses, those types of things going on across the state. And those are all ways that we can increase productivity here in the state.
Yeah, it is. It's interesting because we have that sun, and it stays up for an awfully long time, and we're known for our enormous cabbages, but the fact of the matter is that sun is, that's raw energy. I mean, Alaska has the same amount of energy coming from the sun as anybody else, except for the angle that it comes in at. Mm-hmm. And it's just that it's distributed differently for the most part. And so just to be able to make use of that, it just seems like not insurmountable engineering thing. Well, tell me, Susan Wolsrud of Calypso Farm, if I were living in your neighborhood and I wanted to participate in that farm venture, how would I do it?
Yes, that's a great question. What I think you're talking about is the participating in a CSA, which is not the only way to get locally grown food. There's the farmers markets, there's buying you know, Alaska-grown produce in the store, but also CSA stands for Community Supported Agriculture. It also stands for Community Shared Agriculture. The terms are interchangeable. And what it means is people pay at the beginning of a season, and then every week they get a share of the produce. And there, in the past 10 years in Alaska, a number of CSAs have popped up. In fact, here in the Tanana Valley, we're looking in the order of 10 different farms that have CSAs of different scales. Many of these are very small scale, and a handful are a little larger, or, you know, doing around anywhere from 50 to 100 shares each. Here's the thing is that the demand is much greater than the availability. And so in order to be a part of a CSA, the best time to contact a farm is in February or March. Right now, the farms in Fairbanks, all of them have a little bit of availability left, but it's going fast. So the time that the consumer starts thinking about it, which might be March or April, the farmer's been thinking about it and starting to fill up those shares in January, February. So if you're interested in finding out what's available, Calypso's website, which is www.calypsofarm.org, does list most of the other CSAs in town, and we try to keep it updated as much as possible. We've also been talking with the Division of Ag through the Alaska Grown Division about creating a better clearinghouse of CSA opportunities across the state. So now is the time, and actually a month ago it would have been even a better time to get a space there. And it's, you know, it's not the only option. What we're trying to do is encourage more farmers. We recognize that the need for locally grown food is a lot greater than the supply. And one question that I have about that, because we have Joel here, is something that I want to keep in mind as a nonprofit organization working in this field, is as this demand increases, right now locally grown food, especially in the Tanama Valley, is very popular. People want a connection to their farm. People want to know that this area is getting more and more, you know, self-reliant. There's a huge demand. But what I also want to keep in mind as we grow in this community and as a nonprofit, as we support other farms, is I don't want to leave that low-income population behind and making these possible, you know, making this food accessible. And one thing that we do at Calypso Farm is we offer a sliding scale for the CSA. We help offset that with a place where people can make a donation to help create a slush fund so that we can offer sliding scale. We also take, we take, like we talked about, WIC, food stamps, senior coupons for our produce. But even given that, I don't want to see this food become only available to the upper-income people. At the same time, I don't want to, you know, our farmers are living at the poverty level, myself included. And so I just wanted to give Joel a chance to speak a little bit about that, because I know he has much more experience nationally than we do here in Alaska.
Go ahead, Joel.
I appreciate that. I believe very strongly in supporting locally grown food. And my organization strongly supports, and my previous work at the Department of Agriculture, I strongly support community-supported agriculture, community farms and gardens and a farmer's market. But I must say that that has to be placed in the broader context of, number one, people eat 12 months out of the year. And repeatedly we've had on this discussion challenges, well, last year was a wet year. We'll see if it's warm enough to plant. And that all reminds me that this is not a substitute for serious living wage jobs and a safety net for people who fall through the cracks. And two, I sort of push my, if I can use the word, foodie friends to not forget working class people and poor people, that community food security projects that bring pristine greens into a neighborhood have to be both physically available in low-income neighborhoods and economically affordable in low-income neighborhoods. So it's great what you're doing with the CSA, with a sliding scale. We're doing that, too, in New York. We're distributing some food from our community-supported agriculture for free at pantries and kitchens, and we're also allowing people to use food stamps benefits to do that. So as I point out in my book, some community gardening people say, oh, we should replace food stamps with community gardens. I say, that's ridiculous. Why make it either or? The volume of food by even the most best-run community gardens, even if you pump all the, you know, hot springs energy in the world up there in China, it's not going to feed, you know, 700,000 people in Alaska. So we need that kind of work expanded but balanced with the other kinds of things I'm calling for.
Thank you, Joel Bird.
One other point is, the one thing poor people have even less of than money, than rich people, is time. Only 10% of the people in poverty in America are now on welfare. They're working one or two, three jobs. They're often someone's nanny, and then they have to come home and be the nanny for their own kids. They're often traveling by public transportation, taking one or two, three buses, hours to commute. And then sometimes the foodies say, well, they should be responsible and grow everything from scratch and cook everything from scratch. And I think we just have to realize there's a reason we have modern society where not all of us, you know, no one's saying we should, you know, weave all our own clothing. So I also think we have to keep in mind not everyone has time to grow and produce all their own food slowly, as sort of the slow food mavens say all food should be produced.
Wow, I just really launched something there. When I asked you that question, Susan, of Calypso Farm, I said, how could I get involved? I figured you'd say, well, you bring your spade and dig in here, buddy. It's not like that. It's already
You can do that, too. I mean, Calypso is unique in that we're an educational farm, and so we actually have well over 200 volunteers that work with the organization. So we're always open to that.
Oh, good.
But, you know, and so certainly you can work at any one of the school gardens. You can come up and work at the farm and get involved and grow your own garden. But I think the bigger question is, you know, how can people have access to the food? And that's where, because of Joel's expertise, I think it's really, really important as we grow this movement in Alaska to think about not leaving people behind and how to do that. And it's a huge challenge. And farmers and local food movement people are faced with this all across the country. And so I just, you know, I feel like it's really important to have that part of the conversation from the beginning.
Yes, it'd be interesting to check back and see what's happened with this in another year or two, because I sense we're just at the beginning stages. Let's go to Greg, joins the program from Hoona. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Greg.
Good morning, Steve, and Susan, and Joel. I'd like to just speak very briefly on genetically altered foods. If all your people are going to grow food, boy, encourage them to do genetically or organic. Because GE foods have been on the market now for, you know, longer than most people think. And now there's finally getting to be some research. They're feeding rats and mice genetically altered corn, which is probably the most GE food we have. And they're finding now that 35% of the mice within a year lose the ability to breed. They become sterile. And this is just, it's going to be catastrophic, the effects that this is going to have on us cancer-wise. And so if we are going to go all the work to grow our own food and, you know, and put it on our table and be really proud of it, don't waste your time. Do it with organic seeds. Anyway, I'm sure you guys will comment on that. And another person said that, you know, the fuel goes up, food goes up, fuel comes down, but food and all the commodity don't come back down again.
Yeah, I noticed that.
And maybe there's something can be said in Washington. Department of Agriculture can lean on somebody to make some, you know, to put, but I don't know. It's a democracy, I guess. And the one thing in Alaska that's going to really hit us is the Southwest is running out of water. There is a gal on National Public Radio about a month ago from Canada, and she says, you know, America needs to get it together. They're running out of water, and yet they're creating water parks in the Southwest, and yet their water table are dropping many feet every year, and pretty soon there won't be any. And California's going to have a drought, and that's where a lot of our veggies come from. So we're going to veggies are going to be like oil.
Whoa. Yeah.
It's going to be catastrophic.
Well, I mean, we're going to use genetic engineering to build a drought-resistant crop. Didn't you know that, Greg?
Oh, I just, nothing surprises me anymore. what anybody will do to make a dollar.
Oh, yeah, and they're going to be able to tolerate all that salt there from the irrigation, too.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, I've always wanted to be a botanist and haven't been able to do it because of the economy, but now I can do it in my retirement. I'm building a huge, big greenhouse, which will supply many people veggies, and it's just kind of what I've always wanted to do.
In Hoona. Thank you, Greg. Thank you so much. Yeah, I want to go to Susan. If I were to only work with seeds that I could save the seeds, would I be avoiding all this GM problem?
Yes. You're talking about the GMOs.
Yeah.
Yes, growing open pollinated seeds that you could save yourself, certainly. And that's something that we're working on, developing a seed garden here at Calypso Farm to grow out varieties and make more varieties available here that are suited to the environment and for home gardeners and small-scale farmers. But by growing a hybrid seed, that also is, you know, there are many seeds that are perfectly safe. They're not genetically modified. A hybrid, which many of our food crops, is also, you know, not necessarily genetically modified either.
Yeah.
It's a little complex. But if you have any question, buying a certified organic seed will mean that it's been grown organically without herbicides and pesticides, and it's certainly not genetically engineered. The home gardeners don't at this point, and you know, hopefully won't have access to genetically modified seeds for the most part. What's happening is it's in our food chain. It's in our processed foods. The large-scale growers are using them, and it's extensively in our food chain, and that's the problem.
Yeah, anybody that has any thinks that this is paranoia should pick up the Omnivore's Dilemma and just read the Saga of Corn and it will open your eyes and your brain about all this. Our guests are Susan Wilsrud of Calypso Farm, Joel Berg of the New York City Coalition Against Hunger, as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from BP Alaska. BP is focused on the future, getting more oil out of Prudhoe Bay and bringing Alaska's gas to North America.
All right, well, plenty of calls here and not much time, so I want to try and go as fast as we can through a few of these here. Mark joins the program from Palmer. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Mark.
Thanks, Steve, for taking my call. I just wanted to basically say I've been inspired by folks like Susan up there in Esther and Arctic Organics in Palmer of what they're doing to improve our food security. But a couple points I wanted to make is that there's a huge demand for organic food. And one thing that I learned through Bioneers was there's a community-supported agriculture system in Seattle that is that has hundreds of customers in the Anchorage area. So they're shipping organic food up here that hopefully someday we can be providing through local farms. And then I wanted to just bring in the land use application, too, is that these farms tend to be small, and I think that's great. We don't need to think about preserving farmland in large tracts. We need to be thinking about preserving good growing land wherever we can, community gardens right in the middle of Anchorage or anywhere else, and also small farms, you know, 5 to 10 acre farms, anywhere we have good soil. So that's what I just wanted to get across quickly, and I'll hang up and take comments off the air.
All right, Mark, from Joette, a note that a group of newly minted master gardeners are teaching a class on front yard farming for novice gardeners. Talk about small scale. And that's coming up on April 11th. You can find out more from the Cooperative Extension Service. Let's go to Elizabeth now, joins the program from Sitka. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Elizabeth.
Good morning. I live in senior housing in Sitka, and I've been trying for a couple of years to start a vegetable garden here. We have lots of lawn, and it requires constant cutting the grass. It requires constant cutting. And some of this land should be used to grow vegetables. And I've even had the Agricultural Extension Service man here last year, and he was most enthusiastic. And our manager here in Sitka and his bosses of AHFC in Anchorage show no interest whatsoever in this. In fact, someone in Anchorage just said no to the project last summer, no reason given. And we live next door to the senior center, which serves lunches, and they could certainly benefit from a garden here also. So I thought maybe public awareness could shake the bureaucracy and the AFC awake to the problems of today and how really important it is that we grow some things locally.
Elizabeth, thank you. That's a great story.
So thank you so much.
All right. Yes. There it is. You're all set to do the gardening and the bureaucrats get in the way. That's not an unusual situation, is it, Susan?
Well, it definitely takes some effort to get those things going. And I would suggest talking to gardening clubs in Sitka, if there are any, or talking to master gardeners, because you might be able to get a small group of gardeners who say, we'll help this program get off the ground. Often it takes getting past that groundbreaking stage, the ripping up the grass, the getting the garden in there, and then people say, oh, look how valuable this is. But it takes some effort at the start, and that's something that Calypso does as we work with these schools, is we help them get through that breaking the ground and, you know, convincing the school community that this is actually going to be beneficial to them.
Yeah, that's a real temptation to just undergo some guerrilla gardening, I will have to say. From Sue in Fairbanks, a note about the food bank that grocery stores can help the food bank by having a no-waste policy, but unfortunately, several of our larger grocers in Alaska do not have this policy. And enough said about that. Probably Joel can add to that. You probably saw some of that, Joel Berg.
I do. Interestingly enough, during the Clinton administration, the administration and a bipartisan coalition in Congress agreed to a bill to create federal liability protection against any entity that donates in good faith. In addition, all 50 states have that on the books. So there really is no good excuse, in my judgment, for a company not donating extra wholesome food that they have. I will say, though, there's been a significant increase in that over the last few decades, and as that's happened, companies have actually learned how to waste less food. And so we have less and less ability to use excess food to feed hungry Americans. More of the food given out by food banks and food pantries and soup kitchens is actually purchased food or government food. Food Bank of Alaska told me the other day only about 5% of their entire food supply comes from food drives. And so again, this further reinforces my call not only to have companies donate more, not only to have good projects and to push your housing authorities and other folks to do more to make some of that land available for food production, but to have serious focus on wages and a safety net.
We have an email from Ellen who says, hey, we have a pick-your-own farm here in Delta Junction. Prices are cheap. The farmer accepts SIC and senior coupons, and we also grow our own. She says, you know, it takes time to do the freezing and the canning, but it's worth it. And that kind of puts me in mind that sometimes employers might want to consider allowing, as some do for subsistence, this is another form of securing your own food supplies. And it might be good to have some more liberal personnel practices at some of our employers. But additionally, and I'd like to ask you, I guess, Joel, about this. This person, Ellen, is concerned that the farmer won't be able to afford to continue without an agriculture subsidy such as is given to large corporate farms outside.
Well, the Obama administration has actually proposed somewhat limiting payments to the largest agribusinesses. And I support that. There are a few thousand entities on the island of Manhattan in New York that get farm subsidies, corporations and very wealthy individuals for land they've probably never even seen, they may own as an investment. So that's unnecessary. Small family farmers do need help. They need help with conservation practices. They need help marketing their goods, and there's a lot more the federal government could do to support that, and farmers markets and niche marketing. And I do think we need to even the scales a bit. We're doing an awful lot to subsidize essentially corn syrup, but very, very little to subsidize fresh fruits and vegetables.
Very good. Well, Susan Wilsrud of Calypso Farm in Esther, the Republic of Esther, Alaska, you get a chance to have the last word here.
Oh, I just thank you for bringing this topic up, and thank you, Joel, for coming to Alaska. This is just something, a conversation that needs to keep happening, and I've been just thrilled that so many people in the state care about this issue and are doing their part to increase our food security.
You know, it is just jammed up the phone lines, and this always happens. It's usually a gardening show. I don't think we've ever done a show that just kind of talked about food. We've done subsistence a few times, but clearly there's a lot of interest, and probably we should continue with it. Very, very thoughtful callers today. Thank you so much, Joel Berg.
Thank you.
Well, it's Talk of Alaska. It's Gooseberry Peter at the controls, Pat Yak on the phones, and Len Anderson, and I'm Steve Heimel. Thank you for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by Tel Alaska, a telecommunications company proud to support public broadcasting, sharing the spirit of communications across the great land. Voice data and Wi-Fi technologies at Tel Alaska, on the web at telalaska.com. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.